Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Welcome to Interchange. I'm Lisa Marie Napoli, and I'm happy to be your host tonight for this very interesting and timely show this evening. I'm delighted to have two very special guests in the studios. We have Beth Kate, who is Associate Professor in the School of Public and Environmental Affairs here in Bloomington. And she teaches law and public affairs and does research in a variety of areas, including looking at the Supreme Court as an institution. She is currently co-writing a book with her husband, Fred Kate, on the Supreme Court and information privacy. So thanks and welcome, Beth.
Thank you very much.
And we also have Rob Stone here. He's a medical doctor here in Bloomington, director of Hoosiers for Common Sense Health Plan, and assistant clinical professor of palliative medicine at the IU School of Medicine here locally. So thank you, Rob.
Good to be here.
Good to have you back on Interchange. Tonight we're going to be discussing the recent Supreme Court decision upholding the Affordable Health Care Act, and we're going to be discussing it from a number of different angles. So again, we'd like to welcome Beth Kate and Rob Stone here, and tonight we're going to conduct interchange in three different segments. First, looking at the Affordable Health Care Act, also known as, of course, Obamacare. And we're going to take a few moments to describe it and discuss some of the provisions and mandates with it. We'll next, in the second segment, look at the Supreme Court ruling. And then finally, looked at the overall impact nationally, at state, and even perhaps local levels of Obamacare. So let's start, Rob, if you don't mind. Perhaps you could start to tell us, what are some of the main provisions and mandates that speak to you in terms of the Affordable Health Care Act?
Well, I've always had the Affordable Care Act has always been for me a glass half full, half empty, and so I'm ambivalent about it. I've not actually been a huge supporter of the act because I don't think the act goes far enough. So in terms of the glass half empty, the original projections were that the Affordable Care Act would still leave 26 million people uninsured, even when it's fully implemented in 2018, and so that's about half of the current number of uninsured, which is about 50 to 52 million. Now, the bill has been upheld by the Supreme Court. There's still a chance that the bill, entire bill or aspects of the bill could be repealed, particularly if the election goes strongly to the Republicans in the fall. Because they've said they will repeal it. I'm not being partisan. I mean, they've just said, we will repeal this law. Mm-hmm. The other aspect, though, is that with the Supreme Court ruling that, one of the aspects of the Affordable Care Act was the Medicaid expansion, and because the Supreme Court has ruled that the coercive aspect of that Medicaid expansion is unconstitutional, the current estimates are that maybe as many as 8 million people who would have been covered otherwise will not be covered. So the Affordable Care Act might leave still well over 30 million people uninsured. So that's the glass more than half empty. And I think it's just important to emphasize that because in the New York Times, well, it was yesterday or today, there was an article about mental health coverage in the act, which is good. I'm happy about it. But the author, who's a doctor writing in the New York Times, several times called this bill near universal health care. And that's just a terrible misnomer. Barron Hill said the same thing to me after he voted for the bill. He said he was so happy because this is going to be near universal health care. And that's just not an adequate characterization.
Okay.
On the other hand, if we can cover 15 to 20 to 25 million people who weren't covered before, how can that be bad?
Thank you. And yeah. Beth?
Yeah, from the standpoint of the issues that ultimately have now gone before the Supreme Court, and there's some litigation about some other provisions of the bill that's making its way up as well, including the contraception issues that everyone's heard, I'm sure, about. But the main provisions of the bill that the court was looking at were the individual mandate, what became known as the individual mandate. So a provision that said that by 2014, January 1st, 2014, with some exceptions, everyone had to have a minimum level of coverage that was specified in the law. Or if they did not have, and they could satisfy that in any number of ways. They could satisfy it through Medicare, through Medicaid, through private insurance, through employer-based insurance, or if there were individuals going into a market that the law itself would help set up. But if they did not do that, then they would pay a penalty that would be collected through their tax return. So that was one of the key provisions that was challenged before the court. And then the other one was the Medicaid expansion that Rob mentioned a moment ago. And that effectively was a requirement that the states expand their coverage under Medicaid to populations that they had not necessarily covered before. States have some flexibility to decide who all they cover, and they get federal money and they use their own money as well. But this would have required that for everyone under 65 who is at 133% or below of the federal poverty level, that they would be covered. And some states were setting their eligibility requirements at lower income levels than that. It also would have extended to, I think, families without children or adults without children, which some states had not covered. So it would have expanded what a number of states were doing. And the key aspect that was being challenged before the court, Rob mentioned the coercive factor. What that means is that under Medicaid, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, who administers it from the federal side, would have the ability to withhold potentially all of a state's Medicaid funds if the state did not expand its coverage. As the federal government was going to give the states a significant amount of the money that it would take to cover the new expanded population. And it would pay first 100% of the cost of the expanded coverage through, I think, 2016. And then that would go down ultimately over the next few years to 90%. But the states would have to pick up that 10% over time plus administrative costs and pay those itself if they wanted to expand. And if they chose not to expand, then potentially they might face the withholding of Medicaid funds for people who had already been covered under Medicaid so far. And Medicaid is, I think, Rob, correct me if I'm wrong, it's by far, and certainly the court goes into this in its opinion, the biggest federal state cooperative program. And in terms of the grant funds that states get from the feds, it's way beyond what other programs. I think the next highest level is K through 12 and post-secondary education, and that's at a significantly lower percentage, which is its own issue, which we can talk about another interchange. But anyway, so those were the two main provisions. And then the other big question was, there's a ton of stuff in the Act. I mean, there are all kinds of provisions in the Act.
Sure.
And then the question was, if one or both of those key features get struck down, could the rest of the law remain in place? If so, how much? All of it, parts of it. So,
Rob.
And it might be worth just saying a word or two about Medicare and Medicaid, because people always get confused over these two very large health programs. Both of them started in 1965. Medicare is a universal health program for everybody age 65 and above, and some other people who are disabled or have kidney disease. But basically, you can think of it that we care for the elderly. And it's a universal program. There's no pre-existing conditions and so on. I mean, once you turn 65, 65, you're on Medicare. Medicaid is a very different program. It's a welfare program with the stigma attached to it that welfare programs unfortunately always have. And so people who don't like welfare tend to not like Medicaid because they see it as some kind of a government handout. And Medicaid patients are often stigmatized. Physicians often don't like to take Medicaid patients because the reimbursement for Medicaid is relatively low. Physicians sometimes complain about Medicare reimbursement, but for the most part, actually, physicians are quite happy with Medicare reimbursement. But Medicaid, it's often hard for patients to find a doctor who have Medicaid. I volunteer at the Volunteers in Medicine Clinic here in town, and we've had patients there who had been our patients, and then they became eligible for Medicaid, and they were very happy at first, and then they came back to us and said, "Oh my gosh, I can't find a doctor who will take my Medicaid," but we can't see them once they've got Medicaid. By our rules at Volunteers in Medicine, we can't see them anymore. But Medicaid is a big expense for states, even though the feds in traditional Medicaid pay 60% and the states only 40%. And in this, as Beth was explaining, in this new Medicaid expansion, the feds were going to pay a much higher percentage, I guess all of it at first. But the states are very worried about balancing their budgets, and they can't go into deficit spending the way the federal government does. So Medicaid is a very problematic program, it's been a wonderful program for a lot of people, but it also has been a very problematic program. People go in and out of eligibility, and I could kind of go on and on, and I'll hold my tongue for the moment. I don't want to sound like I'm dissing Medicaid, but as a policy program, Medicaid has a lot of problems. Medicare, on the other hand, I think is a wonderful program, and I think we should expand Medicare rather than be expanding Medicaid. Okay.
And one thing that we should add to put some of these other provisions in context is that two of the key provisions of the Affordable Care Act that really kind of give rise in a way to the individual mandate are what's called community rating and guaranteed issue. And the idea was that the law would tackle this problem of 40 to 50 million uninsured and many of those people not being able to get insurance because of pre-existing conditions. They couldn't get it at all, or they would have to pay incredibly high premiums. Wanting to require that they have access to insurance, so the guaranteed issue is a provision that basically says insurers can't turn people away because of pre-existing conditions. And they also can't jack up the premiums. This is the community rating part. So that premiums will be set based on very few factors. I think age, there's a range of ages, tobacco use, one of the few behavioral things that could actually help set your rate, geography, and there's another one that I'm probably forgetting, but really not the usual underwriting that we have had heretofore, where you walk in and they say, okay, well, what's your health picture look like? Gee, if you have problems, we're going to charge you a lot because we think you're going to cost us a lot. But if you have those provisions where insurance companies then have to provide insurance to people when they come for it, regardless of their health condition, and there's effectively a limited range of premiums that can be charged, they need more people in the pool who are healthy buying insurance to supply the money to cover people who are going to need healthcare now. And so that's really what the individual mandate was intended to do, was to require everyone to be in the pool, to jump in the pool and have healthcare now, rather than do what would be a very sort of normal response if you were sitting around saying, gee, if I'm young and healthy, I don't really want insurance now. And I now know I'm guaranteed that I can get it when and if I need it because the law says that they can't turn me away. So why would I buy it now unless I have to under the law? And so that's where the individual mandate came in. And again, the Medicaid expansion was also, and a variety of other provisions in the law, like subsidies for people to help them buy insurance and so on, who don't qualify for Medicaid, was all sort of intended to bring people into that insured pool and supply funds to those who provide the insurance in the private market, as well as expand some of the government-provided insurance. So that's kind of the big picture.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
So we could just keep going and you wouldn't even have to ask us any questions, but maybe you should ask us a question.
Well, I like this silent hosting here and you taking it over. What I really appreciate about hearing you both speak are just the clarifications you're giving us and providing in very basic terms, in a sense, about the programs and the provisions and that sort of thing. And also, Beth, as you were just saying, how you were sort of giving some practical applications about how this is intended to play out and what may actually happen. So I'm wondering if you have any more examples to sort of bring it more to the grounded reality of what is intended to play out more through the, you know, Obamacare provisions.
Well, I think the idea is they made a decision that they wanted, you know, the big problems in our healthcare are cost, quality, and access. And by access, I mean, you know, the fact that there's roughly 50 million uninsured, and that's about 17% of the population. And no other industrialized, no other wealthy democracy is even close to that. I mean, the next closest is Poland at 2% uninsured. And so that's how bad we are. So access is what they really decided to work on. We're also the most expensive healthcare system in the world, and our quality is not very good. This act has, when Beth mentioned all the little things, the many, many other parts of the bill, there are some pilot programs and some things that might end up improving quality and making the healthcare more affordable. But this bill really aimed at access and put all that other stuff kind of down the road in terms of figuring out and making other hard decisions. And I can't fault the bill for that. I think we've got to improve access because that is where we are in some ways the most starkly negatively compared with our peer countries.
Okay, great. Yeah. And Beth?
And I think the idea was rather than have the government go into something like a single payer universal system, or, you know, you'd really have the government kind of just raising taxes directly. We'll talk about taxes a little bit more a bit later in the wake of the opinion, but and dealing with it in sort of that way with a program that would look more similar to something like Canada or the UK, that it would be shaped as a system that had the states participating, had market players still participating. And so another part of the law would be to set up these exchanges where people could go and look for and buy insurance in a way that was clear what they were getting. It was clear what the costs were. They could compare across plans. And so it would facilitate the access that Rob's talking about, because it would kind of set up a market-based mechanism and try to retain some of the hallmarks of the market right now to go forward, but expand access in that way. So
what do you see, we'll just have another minute or two to wrap up this first segment, what do you see as the greatest strengths or perhaps the greatest challenges? I know you've identified some already, but I'm just wondering what stands out to you most.
For me, the greatest strength of the bill, because, like I said, I've been a critic of the bill in many different ways, although I was quite prepared to make the best of it if the mandate was thrown out, but I'm happy that that the mandate carried through in the end. But I think the greatest, to me, the most important part of the bill, is that it builds on the assumption that our current market-based system has not served us, and that it's going to take the government to step in and take a larger role in order to fix all our problems, all the problems of access and quality and affordability, that it's going to take the government to step in and try to control this crazy marketplace, because the healthcare marketplace is like no other. And that, to me, is what this bill is most about. And of course, that's what the critics of the bill are most upset about, is having more government involvement. But I think the current marketplace has failed miserably, and people are dying because of it.
Okay, thank you. That was the voice of Rob Stone and Beth Kate. Would you like to share your great strengths or weaknesses? Care Act?
I appreciate the Act's effort to try to retain what it thinks will be the benefits of some competition or at least some market mechanisms in there. But But I guess I continue to wonder whether that is really ultimately going to be the best approach. I mean, I worry about access, but also just from my own personal experiences, my family's experiences with our current healthcare system and talking with colleagues, I have the same general reaction to it that Rob just described. And I am hesitant to get too excited about whether the law will deal with a lot of that. So I'm adopting a bit of a wait and see approach, and especially now after the decision where at least some piece of the law is not going to go forward as originally conceived. So we'll have to see what the impact of that is.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you. If you just tuned into Interchange, you just heard the voices of Beth Kate and Rob Stone. We're discussing the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. And we will continue on Interchange. Please stay tuned with more discussion on, in particular in the next segment, we'll focus on the Supreme Court opinions and the ruling that upheld the Obamacare. So stay tuned to Interchange, and we will be right back. Welcome back to Interchange. I'm Lisa Marie Napoli, and happy to be in the station tonight with Rob Stone. He is a medical doctor and a director of Hoosiers for a Common Sense Health Plan and assistant clinical professor of palliative medicine at IU School of Medicine. Beth Kate is associate professor in the School of Public and Environmental Affairs here locally, teaching law and public affairs and doing research in the Supreme Court as an institution. So I feel delighted to have such an expert group here in the station of WFHB to talk about the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. And I promised in this next segment to talk about the Supreme Court ruling in more detail. However, before we do that, something interesting came up over the break about the name Obamacare in and of itself, and just sort of what that implies in a certain sense. And I didn't know, Rob, if you'd like to start with a brief discussion about that nickname, Obamacare.
Well, clearly, the Republicans started calling it Obamacare in echoing back to Hillary Care, which was their critical term for the Clinton health care plan, which, of course, failed in about 1993. But now the Democrats, the White House, decided very consciously that they were going to own the name Obamacare, and they weren't going to let it be a label that was supposed to be a negative label. So now you hear both sides referring to Obamacare. But I really think, you know, this bill, the concept behind this was actually, it was a conservative think tank called the Heritage Foundation that really came up with this idea. And then, of course, the only place in the United States where it's been implemented was in Massachusetts when Governor Romney was governor there. So I really don't think you should call it Obamacare. You should call it Romneycare, or maybe Rombamacare or something like that.
Rombama, that's nice. Little drumming sound to it. And Beth, any impressions that the name Obamacare leaves you with?
I mean, I've largely heard it used as essentially an epithet for people who are very unhappy about the legislation. But I do think it's getting embraced more now. It's sort of, if you can't beat them, use it to your own advantage, I guess, and people do refer to it that way, for good or ill. So I still refer to it as the Affordable Care Act. But.
Great. Well, we're using both terms interchangeably tonight, if that's okay. Great. So let's talk about this Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, as we were referring to. So were there any surprises? Well, we know there were some surprises with the Supreme Court's ruling, and I'm wondering if you could comment on your perceptions about it. Beth?
Yeah, I was surprised by parts of it and not by others. So I think the surprising part was the vote, the fifth vote from Chief Justice Roberts to characterize the individual mandate as a tax and to find that was authorized by the tax and spend power under the Constitution. So that was probably the most surprising part, I think, to many people, not just me. I'll come back to that. But the fact that there were five votes, including Chief Justice Roberts and four other justices, who concluded that Congress didn't have the power to enact the individual mandate as a regulation of interstate commerce or a necessary and proper law as part of regulating commerce, that did not surprise me. I expected that, actually, and I expected it probably before the oral argument and very much after the oral argument. So that was less surprising. One thing that was surprising on the Medicaid expansion, I thought that could go either way. And actually, after the oral argument, I thought it might be, I was more inclined than I had been to think that the states might win that argument. In other words, the states who are arguing that it was coercive to require them to expand Medicaid to this new population or potentially lose all of their Medicaid funding, not just the new block of funding. What they were essentially arguing was that that's coercing them into carrying out a federal program, and what that does is undermine principles of federalism. We have this shared governance between a federal government and state governments, mm-hmm. and that they were really being strong-armed and didn't have a real choice as to whether or not to expand Medicaid. In the oral argument, I thought they made a stronger argument and more of an impression with the justices than I almost anticipated they would. And so coming out, I wasn't sure how all that would necessarily come out. But one thing that did surprise me is they got seven votes for the finding that it was coercive. This is the first time in history that the Supreme Court has found that conditions that the federal government has placed on the acceptance of money by the states are unconstitutionally coercive. That's never happened before. The possibility of that has been discussed before back in the 80s, and listeners may remember when the federal government passed a law that said the states would have to give up a portion of their federal highway funds if they didn't raise their drinking age to 21 mm-hmm. to try to combat states having different drinking ages mm-hmm. and kids crossing state lines to drink where it was lower and then recrossing and getting into accidents and all of that. At that time, South Dakota mounted a constitutional challenge to that law and said they were being coerced into, among other arguments they made against that law, but they said they were being coerced because they would lose these federal highway funds if they didn't raise their drinking age. And that was an incursion on their sovereignty. And the Supreme Court said, you're really, all you're losing is 5% of this pot of federal money. It didn't amount to much in the grand scheme of the state budget. It's really too minimal of an impact be deemed coercive. And the federal government, when it is spending money, has the ability, because it taxes and it spends to serve the general welfare, as it defines it, and so it can put conditions on that spending by the states to make sure the states are hewing to what the federal government wants to achieve with the money. So it said, you know, only if the federal government is holding something back or imposing conditions where the state, it's a deal they can't refuse, does it pose a problem. And in this case, there was so much money at stake and really an inability of the states, as they argued, to make up that money in state taxes. Like if they've said, okay, fine, we're walking away from all of our Medicaid funding, Okay. Now we have to go still provide health care to our citizens. How are we going to do that? Well, we're going to have to tax people. Well, that's on top of federal taxes that those citizens will still pay to fund Medicaid and all the states that do use the program. So, you know, that ultimately convinced seven justices, including ones who were pretty tough on the states during oral argument. So that was interesting to me and a little bit surprising.
Indeed. Thanks for spelling that out to us. Rob, reactions to that or to your own response?
No, I'm in awe of Beth's understanding of all this because this is not my strong suit. So I wanted to ask Beth a question.
Okay. Please do.
So the arguments about how the Commerce Clause didn't apply to this, particularly George Will, conservative commentator, implied that this was a great victory for the conservative cause, that it really limited government. That other, so can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I would be more reserved about that only because I think that government, federal government regulatory power is still pretty broad after this decision. The decision really ended up getting decided with a couple of major themes running through that opinion for the court. One is federalism, this notion, again, that the national government is really supposed to be a government of limited powers. Coming off the revolution, we were very worried about having another king with unlimited powers. And the states wanted to retain real sovereignty over local issues. And not only that, but the notion of shared government between two sovereigns and not concentrating all governmental authority in like a federal government was supposed to, or a state government, was supposed to actually ensure individual liberty. That this notion is that, you know, if the states retain enough power over local issues, they have to be responsive, and they will be more responsive. They're closer. You see these people on the street. You know, they're people you might have lunch with, or your neighbors. So you as an individual, since we, the people, are the seat of all governmental power in the U.S. under our system, will be able to have real meaningful input into governance, and it will be more responsive. But also, states don't have all the power. The federal government has power over certain issues that are inherently national in scope and that you really need a central approach to in order to grow the economy, to provide for the national defense, which you couldn't do with 50 states, you know, imposing their own rules and so on. So federalism is a value in the Constitution that comes across very strongly in this opinion. And what it means in terms of the individual mandate and the Commerce Clause is the powers that the federal government has are listed in the Constitution, and one of them is the power to regulate interstate commerce. And then there's also a catch-all clause at the end that says Congress has the power to make all laws necessary and proper to carrying into effect the powers that the federal government has. Mm-hmm. So it can regulate interstate commerce, and it can make other laws that are necessary and proper to regulating interstate commerce. So the argument was, well, that's what the individual mandate is. Really, it's a regulation of interstate commerce or a law that is at least necessary and proper, because we've got interstate commerce in healthcare, in insurance, or at least the payment for healthcare. And Congress, through the Affordable Care Act, is regulating how people get healthcare and pay for it. And the individual mandate is a way to make sure that all those provisions like guaranteed issue and community rating and so on work. But the main point of contention, which five justices agreed with, was what the mandate is really doing is not regulating commerce, it's creating commerce. Okay? That even though over the years, and particularly from the 1930s sort of on, but really through the history of the country, Congress's authority to regulate commerce has grown and been more expansive because, frankly, the nature of our economy has grown and it's become more interstate and less local. It's become international. It's become internet-based, you know, over time. But nonetheless, there are some limits. And in this case, what the challengers to the individual mandate were saying is, look, what you're really doing is you're saying to people, hey, you have to go buy something you don't want right now. You have to go get insurance. You weren't going to get it, but you have to get it, or you're going to pay a penalty if you don't. And that is not really regulating commerce as such. It's taking someone who is inactive and making them active. So that was the argument. And five justices agreed with that approach over four justices who said, no, really, people who choose now not to get insurance are self-insuring. That's a present activity and we're all in this market because this is a unique market, because almost everyone is going to need some health care down the road and they're going to need to pay for it. And so the argument was, this is really, a market in which everyone's already participating in some way. And so Congress can regulate it. And we don't have to worry, because the great fear was, and this is what persuaded, frankly, the justices who voted that the Commerce Clause doesn't give Congress the power to do this. They said, where's your limiting principle? I mean, if tomorrow the federal government decides...
Broccoli.
I know, I knew broccoli would come up. But we'll put aside poor benighted broccoli. But if the U.S. auto industry decided tomorrow that it's in big trouble again and it needs people to be buying American cars, well, Congress probably could, under the Commerce Clause, do all sorts of things to regulate away the presence of foreign cars, mm-hmm. And maybe achieve that in that way. But could they actually require someone to go in the market and buy a car? Uh-huh. Could they do that? So this was the argument. Where is the limiting principle? Mm-hmm. If you can cause someone to buy something, because if they don't, it will have a significant impact on commerce, on the market that you're dealing with. And so that's really, I mean, those were the arguments. And the interesting thing about it, well, there's sort of a lot of interesting things, but I could go on and on, and I won't. But at the end of the day, it's just sort of a basic, I think, fundamental difference in how the two groups of justices really saw the what was happening, that whether they really bought, on the one hand, this notion that this is a unique market and everyone's kind of it, because we're all going to get there in the end, and so Congress should be able to solve this problem, versus no, we've let Congress regulate lots of stuff. In fact, we've let Congress regulate under the Commerce Clause so broadly that it can ban totally intrastate medical marijuana use, mm-hmm. on the notion that it will be too hard to prevent that from finding its way into the interstate illegal market if it's not banned, even though it's wholly intrastate. No mm-hmm. one's crossing borders to right. grow it, to use it. It's not economic or commercial use in nature anyway. It's medical use. Nonetheless, the Commerce Clause power will reach that because of the potential for a substantial impact on an interstate market. So there's a pretty broad power mm-hmm. that exists, and nothing that the court decided in this case affects the breadth of that power. Uh-huh. That's the difference. So it is a long-winded, sorry, answer to your question. But when the notion that this has somehow cut back a lot on federal power, I guess I would question that, because drawing the line and saying you can't make someone buy something they don't otherwise want right now doesn't eliminate what is a pretty significant breadth of power that already exists in the federal government, and that has not been really undermined or challenged by what's in this opinion. Does that make sense?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Thank you for a very articulate and I must say enlightening perspective about so many nuances, very important mm-hmm. ones and important dimensions about the Supreme Court ruling and what happened and mm-hmm. what we've been hearing in the news and all the hype and the talk lately. Yeah. So that's wonderful, and we're going to continue more. So if you're tuned in, you just heard from Beth Kate. She is with us here. She's associate professor in the School of Public and Environmental Affairs, and we have Rob Stone here, MD, director of Hoosiers for Common Sense Health Plan and assistant clinical professor of palliative medicine at IU School of Medicine. And we're going to take another quick short break, and we'll be back to continue this discussion and specifically point out many of the impacts of the Affordable Care Act, aka Obamacare. Change. I'm Lisa Marie Napoli, and happy to be hosting this energetic Interchange segment tonight. We have Beth Cade, Associate Professor in the School of Public and Environmental Affairs, and Rob Stone, MD, Director of Hoosiers for Common Sense Health Plan, and Assistant Clinical Professor at IU School of Medicine. And we're going to continue this discussion. We just heard a lot of specifics and clarifications about a lot of nuances, I guess you could say, about the Supreme Court ruling. And a question came up over break in our brief discussion here about the idea of the taxes that, what does it mean in reality or in namesake, and how is it going to play out?
Okay. Before I get to that, I just want to make one further comment on what the impact is from the Medicaid expansion part of the decision. So as I mentioned before, the court held for the first time ever that conditions the federal government put on acceptance of federal funding by a state were coercive. What does that mean? Is that going to open the floodgates of litigation? There's been some speculation about this. Will states go in and start challenging other conditions on acceptance of other funds because the federal government has a number of cooperative programs? You know, I'll reserve judgment on that generally, but frankly, I think it's not overwhelmingly likely, only in this sense. Medicaid is so much bigger, and the justices were careful to say, you know, really the court should not invalidate a set of conditions on federal funding unless it's very clear that the states do not have, in fact, a real choice to take it or not. So I hesitate to say that's going to have a big impact either. On the tax issue, the tax issue is essentially that having found that the Commerce Clause doesn't support the individual mandate, that just goes too far, the question is there any other power in the Constitution that Congress could invoke to have this mandate, the mandate that you have minimum insurance or you pay a penalty that goes through the IRS? And five justices concluded that the Congress's general power to raise taxes and spend it supported the mandate because, in his opinion for the court, Chief Justice Roberts said, well, we could legitimately or fairly read it, even though it's not the most natural reading of this. The most natural reading of the mandate is it's a mandate, a requirement to do something, and a penalty if you don't. But we could fairly read it to be a tax. And there, it's just a choice that you choose to either get insurance or if not, you pay a little more in taxes to do it, to not get insurance. So, and that is what ultimately led to upholding the individual mandate because they found another basis in the Constitution for the power. And the court does operate under this general principle, a couple of general principles, as strong as the federalism principles, if you will, when they interpret the Constitution, and that's that they should uphold an act by a legislature unless it's plainly unconstitutional as a matter of separation of powers and deference to the other branches of government and judicial restraint. And so that was animating the opinion. Where they're talking about the individual mandate as a tax. So, but it leads to the natural question, so does this mean, okay, they can't make me buy broccoli, okay, I have to invoke broccoli, but they can tax me if I don't buy broccoli? And is there a meaningful distinction between the two? And so this has given rise to a lot of concern that if you can tax inactivity and thereby motivate activity, the activity you want, people buying broccoli, people buying health insurance, is that any more of a check ultimately on broad federal power than the Commerce Clause would have been, you know? And ultimately, that also remains to be seen. I mean, apart from the natural, I think, political tendency to not want to raise taxes or to do anything that is now going to be construed or talked about as a tax. So you have some just natural political dampening effect on people's, you know, people running out and enacting new mandates and penalties, aka taxes. But whether there's a limiting principle actually in the law for Congress, or can it simply start imposing some taxes if you don't do certain things that, as a policy matter, Congress would like to see us do. There are some limiting principles that Chief Justice Roberts talks about in the opinion, but they're difficult to know how they're going to play out. You know, something that really looks like a penalty or a punishment and not a tax, for example, is unlikely to be deemed a tax and so authorized under this part of the Constitution. So in other words, if, you know, the way the mandate works, it's a relatively small payment. It's meant to, and it's capped, it's meant to approximate what you would pay for a certain level of insurance. It's not like five times what you would pay. It's not punitive in that way. And there are no other kind of harsh penalties about it. It doesn't have the sort of mental requirements for punishment that you see in a lot of other types of like criminal laws, you know, and so on. And so ultimately, Chief Justice Roberts concluded, well, this looks more like a tax because it's really, you know, just meant to approximate what you would otherwise pay. It leaves you with a choice as to whether to comply or not. And frankly, well, it raises some revenue, obviously, if people don't buy the insurance. So in that sense, it looks like a tax. It's collected through the IRS in the usual way. And for all of these reasons, he said it's reasonable to call it a tax. But if there were things that just looked more like penalties that were suddenly slid into the, you know, IRS code, we would question that. We don't want Congress to be able to suddenly convert everything to taxes and be regulating lots of behavior. But he did say there's a difference here because the Constitution says there are limits on Congress's regulation of commerce. The Constitution itself, he said, does not say there is a limit on Congress's ability to tax you into behavior that it wants. And so, you know, how that will play out in the future, I think, will be very interesting to watch. I suspect some of the political forces will be more important in shaping that than possibly the law. So
great.
We'll see.
Great. Well, thank you. And we've spoke at length now in Interchange about sort of the what's going on at the federal level here and the decision mm-hmm. and the impact and the taxing and very important stuff. I'd like to shift it a little bit to the state level, especially because as you talk about the federalism model, of course, when there's a tension between the federal and the state, you know, that's always interesting to explore mm-hmm. a little bit. And you know, just today I heard some breaking news, if I could say, that Governor Mitch Daniels, along with many other GOP governors, Rick Perry and others, are literally refusing to accept the money being given to their states under Obamacare. And so I'm wondering sort of your reactions to that. Rob, perhaps you'd like to start about what that means to you, perhaps at a local and state level.
Yeah, and I didn't see that article, so I don't know precisely, but mm-hmm. my understanding is that they've decided not to accept money to help set up a state exchange. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, under the law, the federal government will set up a state exchange for those states that don't set up their own. That's built into the law. I don't know exactly what that's going to look like. Mm-hmm. The exchanges, though, are going to be interesting to see how they do shape up. In Vermont, for instance, the legislation that they're working on in Vermont to set up an exchange is explicitly being designed so that in 2017, Vermont can actually turn their exchange into a springboard to set up a state single-payer plan, which means a state universal plan where everyone is covered and the government is basically the person who keeps track of the money, but the healthcare system is still privately delivered. So some states are looking at that. Maryland and Hawaii as well are looking at those options. But so exactly what will happen with how the exchanges may evolve over mm-hmm. time is unclear, and it's very unclear to me what is really going to happen in states that don't set up their own exchanges. I think Indiana is probably, I think Governor Daniels is kind of, you know, biting off his nose to spite his face here. It seems a little silly and like political grandstanding to me, but I think we will see, it's not going to stop the Affordable Care Act from being implemented in Indiana.
Okay.
Okay. It'll be interesting to see what states end up rejecting the expansion of Medicaid, and you know, because now they can keep their existing Medicaid program and forego all of that. If they do that, then that's a pool of money. One of the criticisms of the four dissenting justices in the opinion is like every one of these pieces sort of fits together in a shared responsibility for this expansion of coverage. And a big piece of that is the insurers getting this new groundswell of Medicaid patients. It's a huge figure cited in the decision. It's about $350 billion or something like that. Wow. What happens next if there really are those uninsured and the insurers themselves are not getting in that funding? Is that going to affect their ability to cover these increased costs from guaranteed issue and things like that? So it'll be very interesting to see how the states react to this. Presumably the ones who brought the lawsuit are going to be announcing that they're not taking, now they might work something out in terms of still expanding Medicaid, but now that they're not at risk of losing all of their funds if they don't adhere to every piece of the requirements, but it just remains to be seen.
So about half of the expansion of coverage in the Affordable Care Act was going to be Medicaid, and now it's going to be considerably less than half. The other half was going to be then subsidies for people to buy private insurance. And so that's the part really that's the mandate part. So that part goes forward in this law. And so people up to 400% of poverty, which just to put that in perspective would be about 100% of poverty for an individual is roughly, let's say it's a little over $10,000 income per year. For a family of four, it's $20,000 for a family, or is it 15? Anyway, in that range. So family of four isn't four times an individual because families have their efficiencies. But anyway, so up to four times poverty for a family of four is like $80,000 a family of four. Would still get a little bit of subsidy to help buy private insurance. So that still goes forward. And so we'll see how that works out. Now, those people are mandated to buy insurance from private insurance companies, and I'm particularly not fond of private insurance companies. And so that's a part of the bill. I mean, I can see why people aren't happy about the mandate, and people will continue to be unhappy about the mandate when they are forced to buy what I think is a defective product, private health insurance. I'm not fond of the private health insurers.
Okay.
I could go on and on, but I'm holding my tongue.
I think we need a 2 or 3 hour interchange segment for this one tonight. So, Beth, any other additional comments on that?
Not sure on that particular point, but...
That's okay. So I'm just curious, let's think for a moment at the local level. Volunteers in medicine and, Hoosiers mm-hmm. for Common Sense Health Plan. What are some impacts we see? I mean, I'm hearing you discuss these, shifts toward more, private insurance subsidies and that sort of thing. But can you give us some sort of how it may play out scenarios?
Well, we'll definitely find that, some significant percentage of Hoosiers and Monroe Countyans and our WFHB listening area folks will qualify for some subsidies to get private insurance now. And they will be coerced by a tax to do that. Mm-hmm. Some will resist it. Some will take it. Exactly what they're going to get is still a problem because most people are going to end up with what's called the bronze level of insurance, which still has a fair amount of out-of-pocket expense when people do get sick. And it's fairly clear that not only is our healthcare system unaffordable for us as a nation, but it's, medical bills and illness are the largest cause of personal bankruptcy. And the best studies that have been done to date suggest that we will still have people going bankrupt in this country after this bill goes through because so many people have relatively skimpy insurance that will still leave them vulnerable to a lot of out-of-pocket expenses if they do get sick, and they can still go bankrupt from it. So you can still, even if you're covered, you're better off than if you have no coverage, but you could still have some deductibles and co-pays that could leave you with thousands of dollars to pay on a medical bill. And then if you've lost some work because you were sick or injured, that kind of thing can throw you into bankruptcy. So I think that's a drawback of the way the things are going right now.
Okay, great. Thanks for painting that. Not great about that. Thank you for painting such a clear picture.
So some insurance is good. Skimpy insurance is not as good as I'd like it to be.
Okay, good clarity. Mm-hmm. So we have about 1 minute to quickly wrap up, which is a hard one to wrap up on. But I'm wondering if you have any pressing thoughts you'd like to share about this topic before we close our show tonight. Beth, would you like to start?
I guess my heart goes out a little bit maybe to Chief Justice Roberts, who's in Malta, because apparently he needed to go to an island fortress to get away from all of that coverage after his decision. Now, he's there apparently to teach a 2-week class on the history of the Supreme Court, but it was fortuitous. Mm-hmm. But one of the interesting things I think going forward, that now the mandate has been upheld as a valid exercise of congressional taxing power, but I've read a few suggestions that if, for example, Mitt Romney becomes president, that he might simply not enforce it. So there are these enforcement issues because the mandate doesn't have a whole lot of teeth behind its implementation. As you self-report, as you do all of your sort of tax reporting, whether or not you've gotten insurance, I think there's supposed to be some external check on that with information coming in from insurers. But it's also a relatively small payment. So, if people choose not to pay it and not get insurance, how much enforcement will there be? And the IRS doesn't have its usual enforcement mechanisms mm-hmm. to use, like jail time or fines or things like that for non-payment of the fine. So I think that will be kind of interesting to see. Apparently, I read somewhere that, and you may know better about this, Rob, that Massachusetts has had a pretty good compliance rate, voluntary compliance rate. So maybe that will be a harbinger for good. But
great.
Well, I'd just say very briefly that, my ideal expansion of healthcare would be to expand Medicare to cover everybody. It's clearly constitutional. It's cost effective. It's high quality care. So that's in simple terms. I think we should expand Medicare to cover everybody. That's what's meant by when we say a single payer plan.
Super. Well, thank you so much to Beth Kate and Rob Stone here at WFHB. Such a pleasure to learn so much from your perspectives and to share with our community. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa Marie.
And thanks to our producer today, Lewis Malone, and Allison for her assistance. Our executive producer is Allison Bektesh. Original theme music by Jamil Effiam. And stay tuned for the Jazz Show with Kathy Romy. I'm Lisa Marie Napoli, and it's been a pleasure to be with you. And stay tuned to WFHB.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.